It was June 6th, 1980, in the normally quiet suburb of Libertyville, Illinois. Located in the heart of Lake County, it was one of the most affluent communities surrounding Chicago. The residents of Libertyville weren't accustomed to violent crime. Those kinds of things don't happen here, they'd often say, until they do. And when they do, it always seems like evil touches the people you'd least expect bad things to happen to, like Bruce Rouse and his wife Darlene. Bruce was a self-made millionaire. Born in 1936, his family ran a successful service station and car wash in Mundelein, Illinois, another Chicago bedroom community to the north. Raised with a strong work ethic, he worked various jobs before opening four service stations of his own. His fortune was built with those gas stations, real estate investments, partnership in a cable TV company, and by installing aftermarket air conditioners before they became standard in cars. He also married his childhood sweetheart, Darlene Stenlin, and the following year, their first son, Kurt, was born. Their daughter, Robin, was born 3 years later, and William, or Billy as he was known, became the baby of the family when he was born in 1964. In 1974, the family settled into a 13-room, sprawling ranch house-style mansion in Libertyville. The house, situated in the middle of 6 acres of land, was built for around $300,000 and included signature cedar siding, a gymnasium, a wing with an indoor swimming pool, horse stables, and a cottage that was used as a guest house. It seemed like the Rouses were living a picture-perfect 1970s suburban life. You know, the Brady Bunch with three less kids. But all was not what it seemed. Friends and associates would later say the Rouse Mansion was a place of many secrets, an unhappy place of drugs, alcohol, and an undercurrent of violence. And then, during the early morning hours of June 6th, as a severe thunderstorm moved in over Libertyville, Bruce and Darlene Rouse were brutally murdered in their bed. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. With all our episodes this season, we're taking you along for the ride as we go in search of America's murder houses, where the spirits of crimes gone by still linger. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder, violence, and bloody events continue to echo as a haunting. In this episode, we'll be visiting a suburb of Chicago that has a past the current administration doesn't like talking about very much. Even though the town has since been called one of the safest in Illinois, it also once boasted a house with the colorful nickname of the Murder Mansion, which became the scene of murder, mayhem, and the mob. Buckle up for this one. It's a doozy. Every day was always the same at the service station where Bruce kept his office. It was one of the four that he owned, but this one was his first, which also made it his favorite. Every day, Bruce was always the first to arrive. He was the one who turned on the light, started the coffee, and made sure everything was ready to go for the day. Until the morning of June 6, 1980. When one of the employees arrived for work that morning at 8:30, he was surprised to find the station doors locked. The lights were off, the place was silent, and Bruce was nowhere to be found. Well, this was very strange. Bruce was always there, rain or shine. He hadn't mentioned not being in or that he planned to be late. The staff couldn't even open for the day without the cash that was kept in the safe. Without Bruce there to unlock it, they were going to have a problem. He'd have to call Bruce to get the combination. The telephone rang at the Rouse home. Robin, who was 16, answered the staff member's call. When he explained the problem, she put down the phone to go ask her father to pick up the bedroom extension to speak with his station manager. Robin knocked on the closed bedroom door. There was no answer. And this was strange. Her parents never slept this late. In fact, her dad had normally left for work 2 hours before. She twisted the knob, pushed the door open, and stepped into the bedroom to discover a grisly scene of murder and violence. Blood was spattered all over the walls, directed outward from the two twisted figures on the bed. Both Bruce and Darlene had been shot. Bruce had also been repeatedly stabbed in the heart and bludgeoned. The cast-off from the killer's weapon spattered and streaked the ceiling and even the walls on the opposite side of the room. Well, Robin ran screaming from the bedroom and immediately called 911. When the police arrived, all three children claimed to see and hear nothing unusual the night before. Billy told the police that his father had worked late in the evening and his mother had some friends over to play cards. Billy was home all night, he said, watching television until Robin came home at midnight. She'd been at a school dance all evening. The oldest son, Kurt, lived in the guest house on the property and was there with his girlfriend all evening. The coroner would soon establish that the time of death for Bruce and Darlene was 2:30 a.m. All three kids had been home at the time, but claimed to hear nothing but the noise of constant thunder and rain from the storm that was occurring at the time. When deputies from the Lake County Sheriff's Department began searching the property for clues, they found no signs of forced entry to the house. The Rouse kids told them the doors were usually left unlocked. There just wasn't any crime in the neighborhood. Until now, of course. Strangely, though, investigators found that the house had been built with many hidden hallways covered by secret panels. There was even a crawl space under the pool. Since it didn't look like anyone had broken into the house, cops surmised that an intruder could have been in the house for hours, even days, hidden in one of the secret passages, which, by the way, were never explained. No weapons had been found at the scene, but all of Bruce's guns and ammunition had been taken from the house. One of the missing guns was a shotgun, which was probably the murder weapon, or could have just been taken in a robbery. Darlene's purse and many items of jewelry were also gone. However, Bruce's wallet was left sitting in plain sight and had $300 in cash in it. Detectives looked into Bruce's business to rule out any bad deals or disgruntled clients or associates. He didn't seem to have any enemies, so the search turned up no clues, aside from rumors and suggestions that officials might want to take a closer look at those who were closest to Bruce and Darlene, namely their children. The cops quickly found out that things were not as happy at the Rouse home as they looked from the outside. After graduating from high school, Kurt moved into the Rouse guest house. He partied, played loud music, took drugs, and was generally a pain in the ass to his parents. He was constantly fighting with them, and eventually, they changed the locks on the doors to the main house to keep him out. The youngest child, Billy, had his own problems. His parents blamed Kurt for his issues, while Kurt blamed an undiagnosed learning disorder. Regardless, he'd been in trouble as early as sixth grade after vandalizing several local schools. He even once set his parents' bed on fire because he wanted attention. An anonymous neighbor told a newspaper reporter, "He was bad news from nursery school. A gross delinquent, always in trouble of one kind or another, even as a little kid." Robin, on the other hand, was the opposite of her brothers. She was intelligent, got good grades, stayed out of trouble, and was a classic overachiever. She was certainly the favorite child, doted on by both parents, likely because she never caused them any problems. But the police would soon find out that Robin had another quality that would have been praised in any other situation. It was complete and utter loyalty to the family she had left. She would never turn on her brothers. When the Rouse children were asked to come down to the police station to be interviewed, members of their extended family intervened and hired lawyers. The kids were set to inherit a lot of money from their parents' estate, money that would pay for top attorneys who made it difficult for the police to question them any further. Once the family was out of the house, Lake County deputies secured the scene as the investigation continued and the coroner's inquest was held. At the inquest, the Rouse kids, at the advice of their lawyers, of course, invoked their Fifth Amendment rights and refused to answer questions. They also refuse to submit to any other interviews or polygraph tests. With no hard evidence against them, investigators were unable to force them to cooperate. Then 2 months after the murders, Billy showed up at the sheriff's office and said he wanted to help. He asked to see the photos from the crime scene. And while he was warned they were graphic and might be traumatic for him, he insisted. Detectives noticed that he showed no emotion when he looked at the images. He just stared at them. He asked if his mother's purse and her missing jewelry box had ever turned up, and he was told they hadn't. Obviously, then, he told the cops, this must have been a robbery gone bad, right? Well, the investigators were noncommittal. They didn't know, they told him, but they saw what Billy was doing. He was trying to steer the investigation away from he and his siblings. This is a terrible idea, by the way. The cops always see through it, just like they did this time. They had suspicions about the kids, especially Kurt and Billy, but there was no way to prove them. For months, investigators had searched fields, ponds, and gravel pits in the area looking for clues, but nothing had turned up. Then in October, a surveyor named Jeffrey Carlson was working in the nearby Des Plaines River and nearly tripped over a garbage bag. Inside, there was a jewelry box and a woman's purse. He pulled the driver's license out of the wallet and saw the name on it, Darlene Rouse. After alerting the authorities, deputies dredged the riverbed and found 4 shotguns and a rifle, all of which belonged to Bruce. The police could now confirm that robbery was no longer a viable motive, since someone had tried to hide the evidence. Rumor swirled again, now claiming that Bruce had been somehow involved with organized crime. But the police quickly ended those speculations. There was no truth to that, they said. Even though no usable fingerprints were found on the recovered items in the river, the police turned their focus specifically on Kurt Rouse. But more time passed and still no hard evidence was found against him. The case slowed, then came to a halt, and went cold. Each of the Rouse children were later awarded $300,000 from their parents' life insurance policy. That's the equivalent of about $2 million today. Each would try and move on with their lives, but tragedy was not quite finished with them yet. Over the next decade, Robin was racked with guilt over what happened on the night of June 6th. It wasn't because of anything she'd done. It was because of what she knew. Finally, in 1983, she contacted the police and told them she suspected one of her brothers had killed their parents. She set a time to come in and talk with them further about her suspicions, but she never made it. The day before she was set to come to the Lake County Sheriff's Office, she lost control of her car in Racine, Wisconsin, where she was attending college, and died in the accident that followed. Robin had suspected one of her brothers of murder, but which one? Kurt moved to California and later to Iowa, trying to put his traumatic past behind him. After receiving his insurance payout and finishing high school, Billy moved to Key West, Florida, and became a carpenter, but he couldn't stay out of trouble. In 1984, he was arrested after drunkenly stabbing a man over a game of chess, and spent 60 days in jail. After his time behind bars, he tried to straighten out, got married, had a kid, and bought a house. But Billy still drowned his sorrows in drink, and he and his wife frequently fought. He quickly blew through what money he had left from the insurance payout, got divorced, and by the early 1990s was living on a derelict houseboat, stealing money to survive, using drugs, and racking up arrests for petty offenses. And then in September 1995, Billy and some of his drinking buddies robbed a bank and got busted after making off with about $5,000. When reviewing the case, a Key West detective made note of Billy's earlier brush with the law in Libertyville, Illinois, so he made a phone call. Lake County Sheriff's detective saw Billy's arrest as a new opportunity to finally ask him some questions. They now had something to hold over him. And if Key West cops would play ball, an incentive to get him to talk. They also planned to talk to everyone Billy knew, hoping he'd spilled his secrets to some friend, ex-wife, or acquaintance in the years since the murders. Detectives traveled to Florida, ready to shake down every person that Billy had ever known since first landing in Key West. But they wouldn't have to. Billy Rouse was just about to surprise them. Soon after Kurt had left Libertyville for the sunny beaches of California and Billy and Robin went to live with relatives and finished their high school educations, new owners moved into their former home in Libertyville. The house was now being referred to as the Murder Mansion by people around town, but the new owners weren't worried about the house's violent past or its local reputation. They'd soon add their own chapter to the mansion's sordid history. Between 1978 and 1982, the sheriff of Lake County was a man named Tom Brown. It remains a mystery to many people how he was ever elected to office. He was disliked by most county residents and especially by most of the deputies who served under him. He had what might be called a troubling record, a record that became much worse as the Rouse murder investigation continued in the late 1970s. At the time, Brown's close friend, Sergeant Willie Smith, oversaw the Criminal Investigations Division. Reports that later emerged revealed there were an inordinate number of murders that went unsolved in the county during this time, especially murders that were linked to organized crime. And that shouldn't be a surprise since there was only one detective in Lake County who was assigned to cover organized crimes. That was Sergeant Robert Schroeder, who just happened to be a close friend of both Brown and Smith. During Brown's time in office, organized crime had free rein in Lake County. The area was solely controlled by the outfit, the crime organization that had once been run by Al Capone, Frank Nitti, Tony Accardo, and a whole bunch of other names that you'd easily recognize if you know anything at all about Chicago gangster history. By the 1970s, gambling and prostitution had been the main rackets for the outfit for a few years. Card and dice games could be found in the back rooms of many Lake County taverns and restaurants. Back then, betting on sports and on horse races was illegal, but it was easy to find bookies in bars all over the county. Sources inside the sheriff's department later revealed that prostitution mainly occurred at three area locations: a topless club in unincorporated Lincolnshire called the Roman House, another topless bar in Half Day called the Cheetah, and an adult bookstore in Mundelein called Businessman's Consultants. Interesting. When these ventures opened a few years before the Rouse murders, the outfit boss was Joseph Fiorola, a man who was put into place by the old guys who were the last links to Capone and Nitti and who just wanted to retire. Without much oversight, Fiorola started making plans to expand operations into Lake County. His captain started extorting money from the independent bookmakers who were already there, offering them mob protection. You know, the, "I'd hate to see something bad happen to a nice place like this," or, "Boy, you'll have a hard time working with two broken kneecaps," kind of protection. Anyway, Fiorola put enforcer Salvatore Sally De Laurentiis in charge of the Lake County rackets with William B.J. Jehoda, who had worked for the outfit in Las Vegas, as his right-hand man. By the time Tom Brown was elected a sheriff, the outfit's operations were in full swing and now had the promise of even greater sway over the area with Brown in office. He became closely associated with Joe Fiorola. Not to mention, CID Sergeant Willie Brown was the brother-in-law of Sally De Laurentiis, which made things even cozier. Brown became the outfit's law enforcement contact for Lake County. He was paid at least $1,500 a month to warn the mob about pending raids on gambling or prostitution operations by outside agencies. I mean, there was no need to worry about raids from the county sheriff. He even had a hotline installed that went straight to Fiorola's office. Brown was never seen with any outfit associates in person, Payoffs were dropped off at area taverns and restaurants like the Gages Lake Inn, and pickups were made by Brown himself or by one of two other corrupt deputies, Chief Mike Mustel or Corporal Jerry Pankoskis. The latter served as Brown's personal driver and, hey, by the way, was married to Brown's sister. After the Rouse estate was settled and the murder mansion went back on the market, Willie Smith moved in, making the house his personal residence. And it quickly became a hotbed of vice. He organized sex parties, hosted mobsters and prostitutes, and threw wild bashes that became legendary. A deputy later turned informant later described a Halloween party that Smith threw at the murder mansion. It was a costume party, and it was meant to make fun of the fact that murders happened there. All the people dressed in some sort of theme depicting the Rouse murders. Yeah, sounds awesome. Reports also leaked out that the house was used by married sheriff's deputies as a rendezvous to meet up with their mistresses and their badge bunnies. Drinking, sex, gambling, and prostitution were common for months before the party came to an end. Somebody talked. And a story appeared in the Waukegan, Illinois newspaper detailing the rumors that were spreading about the parties taking place at the murder mansion and the possible participation of law enforcement personnel in those parties. Willie Smith quickly moved out of the house, and the murder mansion was quiet again. But not for long. A short time later, using shell companies, the house was purchased by The Outfit, which spent about $50,000 refurbishing the place and turning it into a casino and brothel. Sally De Laurentiis oversaw the operation, which enjoyed, of course, the protection of the Lake County Sheriff. When a deputy turned informant was later asked if the sheriff's department knew about the organized crime casino in Libertyville, he replied, "Knew about it? We were there." He added that not only did illegal gambling take place in the house, but parts of the building were outfitted with massage tables, beds, and private showers. The mob raked in at least $25,000 every night from the operation. Then in May 1982, The Outfit ordered the execution of Robert Plummer, a former independent bookmaker who had started working for the mob after it took over Lake County. B.J. Jehoda, Sally De Laurentiis' lieutenant, was ordered to bring Plummer to the murder mansion, take him through the casino and upstairs where he was to finish him off. And he did as he was told. When they reached the top of the stairs, Jehoda slugged Plummer and then beat him to death. The body was then placed in the trunk of Plummer's Lincoln Continental and left in the parking lot of the Holiday Inn in neighboring Mundelein. The bookie's wife reported his disappearance to the police, but his badly decomposed body wasn't found until 8 days later. The murder wouldn't be solved for another 7 years, largely, it's believed, due to Willie Smith's role as the head of CID for the sheriff's office. It was Plummer's killer, B.J. Jehoda, who revealed the details of the crime in 1989. He claimed to be so haunted by Plummer's death cries, as he called them, that he turned against the mob and spilled everything he knew about their operations to the criminal division of the IRS. He wore a wire to gather information for the authorities and testified against former underworld associates in court. He just wanted to come clean, he said, and get the hell out of the rackets. He couldn't sleep at night, recalling the final cries of Robert Plummer. He got off with a light sentence, while most of his associates wouldn't be so lucky. Around the same time that Plummer was murdered, Tom Brown was defeated in the 1982 election. Not taking any chances, the casino at the murder mansion was immediately closed. Brown had lost to the former coroner, Robert Babcock, who had vowed to clean up the sheriff's department during his campaign. With help from the Illinois State Police, he followed through with his promises. He also made his next order of business the closure of all known brothels in Lake County, putting The Outfit out of the prostitution business. But the mob wasn't done in Lake County just yet. Willie Smith now became The Outfit's contact within the sheriff's department, but unknown to his friends, he was now under federal investigation. In a bind, he agreed to wear a wire and work as an informant in exchange for not being prosecuted. After the outfit's hold on Lake County was unraveled, the new sheriff used Smith as the poster boy for the department's effective reforms. Instead of telling reporters that Smith had been trying to stay out of federal prison, he made it sound as though the corrupt deputy had been working undercover all along, helping to clean up organized crime in the county. Smith became known as Willie the Wire by his fellow officers. Yeah, it's not clear to me if this was a compliment or not. For Sheriff Babcock, however, it seemed like a win. He'd saved the department from more bad publicity and managed to save Smith's job. Surprisingly, or maybe not, Smith was never reprimanded or fired for his part in 4 years of corruption in Lake County. He was even promoted to the position of undersheriff and in 1998 made a run for his boss's job. He was unsuccessful. So I guess crime, only sometimes pays. In 1995, 15 years after the murder of his parents, Billy Rouse found himself on the hot seat at the Key West Police Station. Across from him in an interrogation room were two detectives from the Lake County Sheriff's Department. They'd made the trip to Florida to see if Billy was finally ready to tell them what happened on the night when his parents died. They had been almost certain for years that it had been his oldest brother, Kurt, who had killed Bruce and Darlene Rouse, but Billy surprised them after first undergoing hours of questioning and a polygraph exam. At first, he claimed he had no memory of the night his parents were killed. And then he changed his mind and confessed. It had been him, he told the cops. He had killed his parents. He told the detectives that he didn't want to kill his dad, but he hated his mother. She constantly nagged at him about his behavior, and the only attention he ever got from her was when she yelled at him or told him he'd never amount to anything, just like his brother. Billy just couldn't take it anymore. He described how he'd gone into his parents' bedroom that morning and saw them both sleeping. He put the muzzle of the shotgun to his mother's head, and the trigger just went off. He repeated that he didn't want to kill his dad, but when he woke up and looked at him, the trigger, well, just went off again. But Bruce didn't die, not at first. So Billy hit him with the gun and stabbed him with a kitchen knife until he finally stopped moving. He then drove his father's car to the river and threw his dad's guns and his mom's purse and jewelry into the water. After being extradited to Lake County, Billy was found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to spend 80 years in prison. Today, he remains an inmate at the Pontiac Correctional Center in Pontiac, Illinois, and he'll be eligible for parole in 2035. Billy's confession and trial should have been the end of the Murder Mansion story, but other events took place before Billy robbed that Florida bank that still need to be recalled. After the Mob Casino was closed and the former Rouse home was put back on the market, it sat empty for the next year or so. Occasionally, a newspaper story would appear that contained quotes from discouraged realtors who were having a hard time selling what was then called tainted properties. And the Rouse home in Libertyville was always high on the list of Chicago area properties that fit into that category. Each article aired all the house's dirty laundry. The 1980 murders, the organized crime connections, the casino and brothel, and of course, the murder of Robert Plummer. But there was one article that hinted that it wasn't just memories of crimes gone by that were lingering in the house. Some believe the writer admitted that the house was haunted. Naturally, this article attracted more curiosity seekers to the house than just stories of murders in the mob. Soon, the reports of the alleged haunting multiplied. Surprisingly, though, the accounts passed on by trespassers in the house didn't include ghostly reenactments of the Rouse murders. Instead, most involved unseen hands that grabbed at people on the staircase that led to the second floor. The same spot where Robert Plummer was beaten to death in 1982. Sounds of a terrible struggle were heard, and several witnesses claimed they couldn't breathe, as if someone was choking them when they reached the top of the stairs. More than one person fled the house in terror. Now, were these just wild imaginations at work? Well, here's the kicker. When those ghostly accounts, including what seemed to have been people reliving what happened to Plummer when he was beaten to death at the top of the stairs, were reported, BJ Jehoda hadn't yet worn a wire for the IRS. He hadn't confessed to Robert Plummer's murder. No one even knew that that was where Plummer had died. So how did those people know what to expect when they reached the place where Plummer died? There's no way they could have known what happened there. Unless the place really was haunted, of course. Finally, in late 1983, the house was sold to a building contractor who never spoke to the press about it. He and his family refused interviews and inquiries, remodeled the house, and started making their own memories in the mansion. But fate wasn't finished yet with the murder mansion. On January 25th, 2002, a passing motorist reported heavy smoke rolling out of the windows of the house. Minutes later, the Libertyville Fire Department received a second call, this one from a neighbor who confirmed the house was on fire. Well, fire and emergency vehicles were soon on the way, but they arrived too late. The fire was later determined to have started in the downstairs laundry room and quickly spread all the way up to the attic and set the rest of the house ablaze. Crews fought the flames for nearly 4 hours, connecting 1,800 feet of hose to the closest hydrant and trucking in water from other towns in tankers. By the time the fire was beaten, the house had been burned in half. The second floor and attic were gone, while the first floor was standing but was completely gutted. Fire investigators declared the house a total loss. The mansion stood, blackened, boarded up, and empty for the next year. The owner had walked away, leaving a burned-out shell where a home had once stood. In time, the remains of the murder mansion were finally demolished, and all trace of it has been removed today. The house that once saw tragedy, pain, and horror had finally become a distant memory of the past. There's more show to come, so enjoy these delightful messages from our sponsors.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? And I don't mean like spells or incantations to trap spirits, you weirdos. I mean like a new language that could help you start communicating with more people on this plane today. Then I need to tell you about Rosetta Stone. Look, you know the brand, you know the name. They have the expertise and a 30-year legacy, which makes them more qualified than ever to help you learn a new language today. They've helped millions of people build the fluency and confidence to speak new languages. Now, this is the part where Troy would tell me that I made some kind of grammatical error, but he's not here right now, so like, I don't know, it's like speaking tongues. Rosetta Stone focuses on speaking practice for real-life scenarios to get you ready for real conversations with real people. Or maybe you can even learn how to use some different types of Ouija boards. I don't know. Either way, Rosetta Stone can help you learn faster and retain your new language better. Honestly, Rosetta Stone really would have come in handy for season 4 of New Orleans because I know we butchered some of those French names and I apologize once again. Now, you all know I have a 9-to-5 job when I'm not at the podcast factory. And Rosetta Stone actually helped me not make a total fool out of myself while I was in Brazil interviewing celebrities. Obrigado. And now I want to help you. So don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, American Hauntings podcast listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Rosetta Stone, how language is learned. Wait, by the way, Troy, like, where do words come from? Hey, no, don't walk away. Oh, Troy, where do words...
So, welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 9 of our latest season. We couldn't and wouldn't do this show without you, so Good thing you're listening. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated the episode you were just subjected to. And with me is my producer and co-host. I'm still on the baseball thing. Stepping up to the plate, Cody Beck.
Thank you. Yeah, I need to get my walk-on music like we talked about.
Yeah, I know. We need to do something. Yeah, drop that in somewhere. You're right.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. You know, we'll change it up for next season or something. But what's going on?
Yeah, we'll all get tired of baseball, and then it won't matter. Not that I watch it anyway, so I don't know. Yeah, it's not like I ever watch sports ball. Yeah, but, what do you even move on to?
I don't even know, but what sport you jump to next. But
football. The football I actually like.
So. Okay. You've been all over the place lately. We've been able to get episodes out and stuff, but what's been going on? You've been bouncing around.
Yeah, I just got back from Vegas. I had a great time, went to the Mob Museum. If you saw the pictures, I got to sit in Bonnie and Clyde's death car, which they do not allow and have it since the 1970s, but I guess they figured I'd come far enough
That's awesome.
So yeah, they had to unlock the gates, and you know, it's behind like this glass panel with metal gates around it. So, but I got to sit in it and then like gashed my knee trying to get out of it. Those people were very small back then. I mean, Clyde was small anyway, but I think everyone was small because I could barely get in that car. But I don't know how you'd go, you know, I just robbed a bank. I'm on my way to the car. I hope I was a lot shorter back in the 1930s. Yeah. That's all I got to say. But yeah, it was a really good time. We had a lot of fun. Got to, went in prem at the rather odd casinos there, but it was still a good time. It was a lot of fun, and went out to Good Springs to the Pioneer Saloon, which has a ghost story. It's also, which I think we talked about in our Hollywood season. It was the place that Clark Gable hung out while he was waiting for them to bring Carol Lombard's body down from the mountain after her plane crash. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that, about them going down, her going down on a Liberty Bond drive with her mom, and they were in the plane. And anyway, but this is where he hung out. They've got a whole room that's dedicated to Gable and Lombard, which is kind of cool. Anyway, it's also a very important spot on Fallout New Vegas, which I don't know much about Fallout. Sam really loves it. I watch the TV show. That's as close as I get, but I do love the show. But we kept wondering why there were all these people in like costumes, and like somebody was in like a Vault-Tec uniform. And we're like, what is going on? And then she looks it up and realizes that, you know, that that's where we are. So, which was kind of cool. We chatted with a guy who does a lot of Hollywood stuff, who was also all decked out in cosplay stuff. I guess they have like big gatherings and stuff there. So who knew? Anyway, but it was a lot of fun. So yeah, I when I did my presentation on Bonnie and Clyde on Saturday night, I met one of our Patreon subscribers, Jen, who I think had already taken you to task, but she did it again for my benefit about the time that you said you hated Vegas. So
she didn't
appreciate it. Yeah, I know. But yeah, I met her and her husband, which was super cool. So that was really fun to get to meet people, you know, on the far side of the world there, you know, that you don't expect. So that was pretty cool. I've been back trying to get ready. I mean, the clock is ticking for the conference. That's what I've been working on, trying to get my presentation together for the conference and get everything nailed down, and working on this is my current to-do list, as you can see it.
Yeah, tiny.
So yeah, it's not tiny, but yeah, so working on that. But this is everybody's last chance. That's your deadline. Deadline is next Friday, June 14th. That is the last chance to get the discount price. I mean, you can come show up at the door if you want to, but why pay more when you can just get a ticket ahead of time? It's just easier. But I don't know. I don't think people want to miss this. It's going to be a really great year, bigger and better, more people. More fun, new speakers, new vendors. My Without a Trace book, number two, the one that I wrote because of the podcast, that will be available at the conference. So we still have some space for some of the after hour events too. I've been popping those up on my Facebook page. We only have just a couple left, but I know there's one on auras, which is beyond my comprehension. I don't understand it, but Sherry Brake does. And there's one on residual hauntings, which I do understand, that Carrie Bergen is working on. And I also have one that April only has a few seats. She's did two this year. So one of hers still has a few spots, the one with Matthew, and he's got some kind of high tech stuff, which I'm going to be, I'll be posting on that today. When everybody hears this, it'll be up on the Facebook page. And Amanda Woomer is doing one on grief. I don't know if you remember this or not. I don't think you knew her that well. Rosemary Ellen Guiley. I think you met her maybe 1 year and then she passed away. But she always did a lot of grief and dying and dumb suppers and that kind of stuff that people put people in touch with their loved ones who are gone. And so she would have really dug what Amanda is doing this year at the conference. So if you know, if people get a chance and want to re-experience something like that, you'd be in very good hands. So anyway, check it out. We've got some June events, but I got to be honest with you, they're mostly sold out already. So yeah, sorry. I got a St. Louis exorcism one on the 15th, but it's only got a couple of seats left. Gangs of Southern Illinois on the 29th, just a couple of seats. The only thing really available is the Night Behind the Museum that I just added, because the one I did last weekend sold out. And I have to be honest with you, and I know you're going to say, oh, it's just because it's new, but I don't always feel that way. That was probably the most fun I have done doing a presentation in, I can't remember when. We had a really great group of people who laughed at all of my stupid jokes, which is always fun. You know, and so that's always a bonus there. But you know, this thing is put together with the idea of telling people the stories about things in the museum that have a story that will not fit on the cards, you know, on the cards. And I got to talk about stuff that, you know, we have, but people don't know much about. And that has been fun. I mean, it's the story behind like that really gruesome, you know, a post-mortem photograph that we have giant blown up on the wall. People always ask. And I always say, now I'm telling them, you're just going to have to come and hear the whole story. If everyone wants to know about the story, the whole story behind Sam the Doll. And so I've got it all. I've been working on that, trying to collect everything I can. So anyway, come check it out. It has been a lot of fun, and I think you'll have a good time. And we just put this one up for the 28th, I think a couple of weeks ago, and we're about half full, but there's still plenty of spots left. So join us. It is at, all that stuff is at dinnerandspirits.com. I've got July and August stuff up on there, and we got a brand new tour that we're just starting in July, but I'll wait. I'll talk about it later. Cause you're going to let me ramble too long. And so anyway, also reminded me, because we saw Jen about the Patreon program. When we had this thing last weekend, I had so many people who were Patreon subscribers that I didn't even know were
Patreon subscribers.
I mean, a couple of them I did. I mean, I knew Rick was, but and Rick came and was talking about how much he liked this season. And it's been kind of cool. And somebody's going to owe me royalties because or I probably owe them, so let's not talk about that. But a lot of these people are like, I never watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre before, and now I've seen it. And a lot of them were like, well, I didn't watch it because I thought it would be so gory. And then they, you know, the secret was revealed in the last episode that there's actually no blood in this movie. It's all in your mind. But anyway, if you're wondering what the hell we're talking about, this season of Patreon is a kind of a back and forth between the life and crimes of Ed Gein, the nutcase, you know, grave robber, body snatcher, the whole bit. And it goes back and forth between that and the making of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which was inspired by his crime. So anyway, it's worth it if just for that. If you don't sign up for any of the extra stuff, I mean, for $5 a month, you get a brand new podcast that you can't hear anywhere else. So we have a new podcast for Patreon people every single week. Not just this week, but next week, too. They'll have another one. And it's already ready to go. I am so up.
Beautiful.
Well, I'm trying to stay ahead of it because I don't want to get behind with the conference. So anyway, check it out. It's at patreon.com/American Hauntings.
Beautiful. And yeah, just to give a quick shout out to some of our latest subscribers. So thank you very much to, for subscribing to the Patreon, to Tarina, Kelsey, Appel, Ben, Rebecca, and Robin. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Yeah,
we appreciate it.
We also have a listener review. And speaking of owing people royalties, this one's interesting. It's from DHAKDUCJ.
See, that's why I just started referring to people by their, you know, their area codes.
Yeah, so. I got nothing else to go on, though, because it's either I get a username, but I don't want to mispronounce anything.
So yeah, right.
This one.
Oh, gee, because I'd hate for that to happen.
Yes.
Us mispronouncing something.
And then get
which,
yelled at
yes,
later.
We got another one. We'll get to that.
So. This review is titled Became an Unofficial Tour Guide. Said, I listened to the New Orleans season in preparation for a friend's trip to the Big Easy and astonished them with all the knowledge I learned from the podcast. Thanks to Troy and Cody, I was dubbed the tour guide of our group.
Oh, dude, I'm so sorry. Listen, there's nothing I hate more than every time I go. Well, you were there the last time we went. Yep. And people are always like, oh, you know, I'll say something and they'll go, oh, well, tell us about that. And my answer now is, why don't you just listen to the podcast?
Yeah.
Because if you listen to the podcast, you'd already know what it was.
Exactly. But
yeah, I have to plan everything. And yeah, I'm so sorry. So
they go on to say, I love the format. If you're short on time, you can just listen to the monologue. But otherwise, you can stick around for the chit chat after the monologue to really cement the facts in your mind and get a little something extra. They don't just regurgitate the same rumors and myths propagated by other tour companies. They research and verify using primary sources. Can't recommend enough. So thank you very much for that review.
Yeah, not everybody felt that same way about our New Orleans season, I noticed, though.
Yeah.
Should I read that one? Because, you know, whatever. We don't value your feedback. But, you know, in this particular case, this one is said, so disappointed in the show. This is the review. The actual talk about the various places is around 20 minutes. Okay, I don't think you've listened to the podcast all the way through, but okay. The rest is this just these two guys talking about other things that are spooky. I was really looking forward to the stories from New Orleans because I love the city and know its history. What a letdown. Man, dude, I don't know who this was. I'm going to guess they're not listening anymore, and that's fine. But hey, at least you left a review because that's what we need. But maybe try that again because you missed something, apparently. Yeah, I don't know if you had it on. I don't know if you had it on like high speed or I don't know, but there was an awful lot of episodes there with an awful lot of history. But, you know, I guess to each his own.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just think it's funny. It's New Orleans pops up around this time every year because and again, guys, I haven't done it yet, but I promise once the conference is over, I will put together a New Orleans travel guide.
Yes.
And put it up onto the website so that we can
be beautiful
you guys to it. So because I, you know, I'm still getting requests, which I don't mind, and I'm happy to give you what I can. Somebody just asked me the other night at the night behind the museum about
nice.
What tour is it in New Orleans? Yeah.
Well, so, beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a Murder Mansion.
Sure. Yeah. Now, before we even start, mm-hmm. I got to tell you, this was not a story that when I first went into it, and we're talking probably early 2000s when I first, well, I guess really, I heard about this, pretty early on, early 2000s. And a friend of mine from Wisconsin, Karen Spaeth is the one who turned me on to it. Her brother, I knew her brother. He used to be a tour guide. Now, here's a convoluted story, not too bad, but a little. Her brother was studying to be a Lutheran minister in Gettysburg, but he was also a ghost tour guide.
Interesting.
And he was studying at the Lutheran Seminary in Gettysburg. And so I met him because he took me to some of the haunted buildings on campus and was telling me the stories. Real nice dude. And then I knew Karen because she used to come down when we used to have the bookstore in Alton, again, late 90s, early 2000s. And then Karen is the one who turned me on to this story in the first place. And I've always really liked this story. I mean, it's not that much of a whodunit, you know,
mm-hmm.
but the whole what happened next
right
at the house is the kicker, I think. So
yeah, anyway. I was su- surprised that before I got to the what happened next stuff, I thought that this was going to be
a really short episode.
Well, no, I thought it was going to somehow turn into like another Amityville sort of thing.
Sure.
You know, I'm glad that it didn't. But that's just kind of where I figured that media would run.
No,
with
it's
kind of
like
would...
Amityville meets Goodfellas.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly.
Except the trashy gangsters from the 80s. You know, it's just, you know.
Yeah. And
I guess, I guess it was the end of Henry Hill rather than the beginning. So.
Right. And that's that stuff's the more interesting stuff. But I do like that you talked about, you know, the house seems amazing, having the secret passages and stuff.
Yeah. And you know, and I can only found that ever mentioned once. Mm. And I found it in one article and they were talking about it. And I'm like, yeah, it was a credible source. It just that I'm like, why?
Yeah.
Why were they there?
Right.
I mean, I could see if the mob had put them in, but
sure,
this was before that. So why were there tunnels? I mean, you know, why were these secret passages there? Of course, you know what I thought. Bad times at the El Royale.
Oh, right.
I'm
right.
Thinking it's a little Peeping Tom action going on with the rooms or something. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. But yeah, it makes you wonder why they were there. I just don't get it.
I guess you're building a house that big,
I guess you got money to burn. I mean, right. What the hell?
Just something you do. Man.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, and one of the other things I noted when you said about Billy setting his parents' bed on fire once to get some attention.
Yeah, nothing wrong here. Yeah, I don't know why no one realized he was a complete juvenile delinquent psychopath in the making.
Right.
The neighbors knew. I like the neighbors. It's been trouble since nursery school, and I felt man.
Yeah, definitely some interesting characters. I wasn't gonna. I mean, you made it pretty clear. Pretty hinted toward him a lot. But my money was gonna be on Kurt.
And then Kurt turned out to be like the most boring of the bunch. Not at first. I don't think during his, probably I'm gonna picture a lot of Led Zeppelin out in the pool house or the guest house, right?
Yeah.
I'm probably out there smoking a lot of weed, playing a lot of Zeppelin, some Rush. I'm trying to think of it, late 70s.
That time, but yeah.
Pink Floyd. Oh God. A lot of Pink Floyd. I'll bet there was regular watching of Wizard of Oz going on out there with the Dark Side of the Moon. But yeah, so I guess he was troublesome, but not really trouble, just not what they were looking for. I mean,
right.
He was just a disappointment as a son. And I can relate to that. I mean, I get it. as a fellow disappointment of a son,
right.
I do get that, So I never got locked out of my house, but
yeah.
I can see where, it sounded like, from everything that Billy later said that he got along fine with his dad. It was his mom that was the nightmare. So,
yeah. I didn't really see that part coming.
I didn't see
either.
That coming either. Doesn't it seem like that, it's your dad? I mean, okay. So let's go back. Amityville Horror.
Mm-hmm.
It was the dad that he was fighting with all the time, not the mom, but I mean, she must have just ragged on him. And well, again, this is going back to some of those other stories we talked about, like the Easter Sunday Massacre. Mm-hmm. We're only getting one side of this story.
Right. Right.
For all we know, she yelled at him once, and it stuck with him for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Dude's a wacko. So it's hard to say, what really happened, but yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound great, but, I don't know. It's hard to say. It really is.
Right. I guess the last question I have just about that part of the story is when they find the garbage bag or the jewelry and then the four shotguns and a rifle, did he take all that stuff because of the robbery, fake robbery?
Yeah, trying to make it look like it was a robbery because, I mean, what are you going to steal? I mean, obviously the dude's got he's a teenager.
Right.
This happens, right? He got a very short attention span. So he's going to go for whatever he thinks is worth the most.
Uh-huh.
So he grabs all his mom's jewelry, grabs his dad's guns, doesn't think about the wallet with $300 in it, which was worth a lot more in 1980.
Sure.
Than, what we consider 300. But even so, I mean, if somebody was burglarizing your house and you left your wallet with $300 in it, they're going to take it. Right.
Right.
But so he didn't really wasn't really a lot of great planning, which is why the police suspected the kids had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. Although they really did think it was Kurt because Billy was the baby of the family. I mean, they knew it wasn't the sister. I mean, yeah, you know, talk about anal retentive. I mean, overachiever here. But you know, while she didn't talk, it obviously ate at her because, you know, she never did really say anything, but she was going to. Robin mm-hmm. was going to talk, but they never knew who she was going to pin the blame on. You know, yeah. They still thought it was Kurt. So,
and once that happened, I was like, oh, okay, now we're going to get into some conspiracy thing or something, you know, or
and yeah, we'll come back to that.
Yeah, let's talk about the outfit and the murder man, yeah. and the crazy. Yeah. Crazy parties and this
yeah
sounds amazing.
I mean, you got to remember by the 80s, you know, late 70s, 80s, the outfit has seen better days.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, they've already been hit several different times with a lot of arrests and shakedowns, and you know, they're nothing, they're certainly not. I mean, the guys that are left are the guys that are, you know, with some, the old guys with some connections to, you know, Tony Accardo and Giancana and guys like that. And they just want out.
Yeah.
So it's the you know, the kids that are running things now, and things get sloppy, you know, mm-hmm. obviously get sloppy. But, you know, they had a good way to run things in Lake County because, you know, they had a dirty sheriff on their payroll for 4 years.
Right.
And don't worry. I was afraid you'd panic. No, it's all public record. Don't worry. I didn't say anything that wasn't public record.
Okay, good.
So
good,
I'm
good.
Pretty sure he's dead anyway. But yeah. Even if he's not, I wasn't worried about it. None of these guys are still alive or still active, and everybody knows they were dirty. And it's, like I said, public record. Now.
Perfect.
But yeah, it was 4 years of some pretty sketchy stuff going on. I mean, this was... You know, this was the kind of stuff they were doing back in the Capone days, but this was just so blatant. And, you know, I don't know. I know everything about the late 70s and early 80s just makes me think of disco suits and stuff. And it just all feels tacky to me. So
well, it seems like they were like, maybe they even just knew they're at the end of like a dying.
Yeah,
kind of breed.
I think so. I think so. Yeah, it was time to move on to other things. And, you know, they're still running, you know, they're doing what they can with the old fashioned stuff here, you know, gambling and prostitution and stuff. But, you know, it was nothing like it used to be. And now they're trying to keep it going. And the only reason they can keep it going is because they've got an in at the sheriff's department. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, look what happened. As soon as he was gone, you know, everything shut down after that. So that right. was the end of the road. So,
and I was curious about he, you know, Tom Brown loses the election to the former coroner. And I was like, was right. the coroner just like, yeah. I've seen all the bodies. I'm tired.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the thing about coroners is, you know, most of the time, you know, and I think that we've talked about this too. The medical examiner is a doctor. Mm-hmm. The coroner is a political position.
Right, right, right.
I mean, we got a coroner here in town who's like this, I'm not going to name any names, but it's like this woman who used to be used to do photography as a hobby because her husband had a lot of money and she didn't have to work. And now she's the coroner. And I'm like,
great.
And how did that happen? Exactly. Because it's a political position.
Gotcha.
And so this guy, and so is sheriff, honestly, most of the time guys who, you know, are sheriffs of counties, not usually, they're not all, well, I shouldn't say usually, in many, many cases, they're not law enforcement people. They haven't come up through the ranks. They, I mean, a lot of times guys will run for mm-hmm. sheriff, but a lot of times it's a political position and they're, you know, they were doing something else and that came up with something good. Back in my old hometown, we had a guy who became the sheriff of the county after, like, because he donated a lot of money to stuff around town. I mean, literally, that's it.
Yeah.
And he liked dressing up in the outfit and stuff. I mean, you know, seriously. So, you know, I think in this case, this guy had seen all of this corruption and all of the things that were going on. And he ran with the idea of, I'm going to put a stop to this. And by this time, nobody liked the sheriff anyway. Nobody liked Brown. And they knew that things were dirty. People knew the mob was active. And so they were just kind of like, okay, let's vote for this guy. And then, you know, we've still got, you know, we got one guy left, and you know, so we're going to make him the poster boy for cleaning up. You know, old Willie Smith is now the you know, oh, he was working undercover the whole time, wink,
sure.
wink,
right?
You know, so But yeah, I like the fact, I mean, you know, I like the fact that they tried to say that, you know, all his coworkers called him Willie the Wire as a nice thing. Yeah, dude, it wasn't a nice thing.
No,
it
was not.
Yeah, not a compliment. They think you're a rat. So nobody's going to tell you anything ever again. So,
yeah, I'd never considered the fact that Woody from Toy Story was elected.
What?
Woody from Toy Story.
No. Now, he was an old-time cowboy, so he probably wasn't elected. He probably had to be hired because he was a fast gun. Well, he's the quickest draw in the West or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's like one of this.
Snake in my boot, right? So, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, so that's kind of just seems like the end, almost like the end of an era or something. And
yeah, I mean, I can't imagine what that house must have been like. I mean, and you know, they did have neighbors. I mean, not close. They were on quite a few acres there. But even so, there's no way to miss all the cars coming and going and the parties going on and late at night. And I mean, you know, I mean, and the house was like a, you know, like a stabbing cabin for all these sheriffs who were on duty and got their mistresses and their badge bunnies out there and stuff. And, you know, it's like, man, what the hell?
It would be great to have a side story of like the neighbor's point of view, because they can't call anybody about it. They can't.
Who are you going to call and complain? I'd like to file a noise complaint. Yeah. You know, you'd never. That'd be the last call you ever made or something.
Right. Well, then after, you know, the alleged ghost, I guess, of Robert Plummer, because of that spot that people wouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, you got to admit that's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. That's the thing that impressed me about that story is it popped up and they kept talking about it. Now, keep in mind when the story that I, or when the article I found that mentioned this was written years later, when we knew about, it was after 89, we knew about Robert Plummer by that time. But back when people were experiencing this, no one knew anything. Mm-hmm. They didn't know somebody had been shot there. They didn't know anything about Robert Plummer. They didn't know who done it. They knew nothing. And yet people were having an experience right there on that spot.
Yeah.
Now that is creepy.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's genuinely creepy.
Yeah, those are my favorite type of ghost stories and stuff. And that's kind of what we set out to like talk about initially when we started the podcast, you know, and things like that are great. And then unfortunately, January 25th, 2002, the mansion burns
to the ground.
Yeah. Did you ever get like any more details about that? Like what happened?
But do you want to know? I'm going to say that you got to remember this is not that long after all of this stuff happened. And, you know, my guess is these people are working on the house and they're doing some renovations. And my guess would be there were probably some things in the house that they didn't want people to find. That would be my guess. Don't know. We know about Robert Plummer because a guy wore a wire on the mob. But what about anybody else who might have disappeared in that house?
Yeah.
You know, so I would say there's a good chance that there were some things that needed to be hidden, because don't you find it odd that the owners, this guy's a building contractor, the house burns to the ground and they just upped and moved.
Yeah, right.
Never demolished. They just took the insurance settlement and got the hell out of Dodge. My guess would be, and I didn't hint at this, I thought we'd save it for our discussion, but my guess would be that, you know.
Yeah,
something was done to cover something.
Interesting. So the illegal activity kind of continues throughout the end of the end of the era,
all the way to the end.
Man, well, that's awesome. That's all I had for that. It's unless there's anything else you want to talk about with the outfit. Cool. I know you love the mob stuff. So.
I do, and I don't want to give anything away. So.
Okay.
I'm gonna say.
I don't have any Ghostwriter stuff this week again. I did get some emails. I got some that are some pretty good stories, and then things.
Oh, good.
Like, hey, you know, thanks for this, thanks for that.
Awesome. Well, you can always read that stuff. People like hearing that stuff. But
yeah, I might start to check.
Yeah, do that. I mean, yeah, do with that, because I do have text messages though from the hotline. Yeah,
yes, please.
So if you guys want to send us a quick question or a comment about the show, you can email Cody, as he already mentioned, at Oh, I have. That is not the right. Is it American? Oh, yeah, it is. AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, sir.
Yep. You can get a hold of Cody, or you can text us on the hotline. And this number, and I'll repeat it at the end, but this number is 217-791-7859. And it may get read on the show. Sometimes I just answer things if it looks like it's something that needs to be, you know, answered a little quicker than when we get around to it on the show. Mm-hmm. The first one comes from Aaron. I believe he has texted us before. And I'm trying to see where he's at. He's in the 217. So I'm pretty sure that he has texted us before, but he wanted to know if I know about or had any recommendations for haunted tours in the Gatlinburg, Tennessee area. I have never taken a ghost tour in Gatlinburg, but you know, that never stops me. I was commenting on Savannah last time and I hadn't been there, but the Vogels had. But I did look into it just to see, because a lot of times all it takes is the website.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't want to go. In this particular case, based on the reviews and based on some of the things I saw, I would suggest checking out, if it was me, I would check out the Ghost Walk of Gatlinburg. It looked like, honestly, looks like the best one. They seem to have the best, best website, best information on their website. And they definitely have the best reviews. So if you do, though, Aaron, let us know. That way, if somebody else asks, we'll know if it's terrible or if it's great. I'd like to know either way. So we also had a message from the 602. It only has two words and it's not anything bad, but one of them is hyphenated and it's Dietlov Pass. That's all it says. No more of the Dietlov Pass, because we don't know it's, but I believe the pronunciations we have been given. I'm good. So, but just please don't ask us to do an entire episode on it, because we're not going to.
I would
not do it just because I can't say it.
So. Exactly.
All right. So this one comes from the 317, which I believe is Indiana. But this one says, ha, 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 just heard this on the show. 4-year listener. Love it. Much thanks. Every time I see American Hauntings, I hear it to the tune of American Woman by the Guess Who. So thanks again for the quality spooks. I never thought about that, but
I know I'm not gonna not think about that.
Yeah, no kidding, right? So, and this one comes for the 217. This one says, happy Memorial Day weekend. So it was last week, but is there a podcast about the asylum in Peoria, Illinois? I'm trying to find more info about it. Now, we haven't done one. I have written about it in my book Ghosts of the Prairie. It's in there. But I have not done a podcast on it. Maybe someday it'll come around that we do. I don't know. It's hard to say. I would think there's something out there. Look for something with some decent history, though, because there's some pretty wild stories that have been told about it that are not accurate, and some really good ones that are. Just be careful what you find. But I don't know of anything off the top of my head, so I'm sorry about that. Oh, and I meant to look this up. Oh, God. Okay, I'm saving this one for next time. Okay. So, Morticia, I will get back to you. I meant to look this up, and I forgot. So, and I don't want to do it while we're sitting here on the air, so to speak. So, I will get back to it. I promise. Okay, this one comes from... Uh-oh. Yeah, I forgot about this one. This one is from the 250, and we made a mistake in our last episode. When we thought we'd gotten our first text message from Canada, we didn't. So anyway, hi again. She didn't stress it. I am. Cody. I just listened to the Goat Castle episode, and afterwards you said that you had your first text from Canada. I'm actually texting you from British Columbia, and I texted you a while ago. Sorry, Laura. We're sorry. She says, LOL, do I get the award for the first Canadian text? Yes, you do. Yes, you do. We will make you listener of the week. How's that?
There you go.
I don't know what comes with that. Probably nothing, but you can treasure that if you'd like. But either way, love the podcast, Laura. So thanks for being a good sport. And we're sorry that we forgot. We're lucky to remember what the last episode was about, to be honest.
I know.
So, I happen to have a sheet up on my wall here that has the list of the podcasts on them. That's how I keep track of what we're doing next, because I probably would not remember. So Anyway, all right.
Is that it? That's all the text?
Yep, I'm all done, man. Yep.
All right.
So, yep. Oh, I'm supposed to say it again. So if you guys want to text us, it is 217-791-7859.
Awesome. Well, I say we wrap it up then.
All right. Sounds good to me. So thanks for listening, everybody. Share the show with your friends, neighbors, anyone you know. If you like the show or like that one person, even if you don't, leave us a review on iTunes anyway, or send us an email or drop us a text on the haunt line. You can also check us out on our social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook, Instagram, and, well, sometimes Twitter. Yeah. Also, don't forget, use the discount code podcast when shopping for books, tours, events, whatever, at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, AmericanHauntingsClothing.com, and you can use the same code there. That code is podcast, and you'll always get 10% off everything you order. And I can't remember if I said that this was written by Troy Taylor, and oh my God, that's me. We have a listener who loves for me to say that's me. So I'm trying to remember now because sometimes I forget. So I think I remembered, but if not, I did it again. So over to you.
All right. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck.
See, you got the me in. I wrote yours in, but
you did. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, and photographs to go along with each episode. Thanks again for listening. Uh-huh. Definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
See you later.
Okay.
That was fun.
That was fun.
Yeah, usually Mondays.
Growing businesses and finance professionals, you need Bill Spend and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software. It's powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card, which helps growing companies scale with credit lines of $500 to $15 million, automated expense reports, and as many virtual cards as you need. For a limited time, get $500 when you get started with Bill Spend and Expense. Request a demo at bill.com/get500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.